Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Designer Russell Wright, who lived from 1904 to 1976, revolutionized the American home through his contribution of inexpensive, mass-produced dinnerware, furniture, appliances, and textiles. His home, studio, and woodland garden, collectively called Manitoga, are located in Garrison, New York. Manitoga is a National Historic Landmark, an affiliate site of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and a World Monuments Watch site. It's one of the few 20th century modern homes open to the public in New York State. I went to Garrison last week and spoke with Allison Cross, the executive director of Manitoga. Allison Cross, thank you so much for showing me around Manitoga.
My absolute pleasure.
Before we talk about all of the delights the property has to offer, give us, if you would, a brief life story of Russell Wright. I know it's hard to do it in brief, but don't worry about keeping it too concise.
Okay. Russell Wright grew up in Ohio, in Lebanon, on a farm. He has a Quaker background, always interested in nature and in design. He started in a law program, but decided that that was not his course. Studied theater design early on, and it was in that stage, and in fact studied and worked with a Norman Bel Geddes. It was during that time that he met Mary Wright, who was to become Mary Einstein, who was to become his wife. She had also studied design. Very soon after they met, he started working in product design. And though his early studies and foray into theater never left him, and we see that at Manitoga, known as really one of the first industrial designers, because at that time, of course, in the late 30s into the 40s, pre-war, machinery and mass production and new materials, actually before, during, and after the war, informed his practice. But while he worked with General Electric and DuPont on some appliances and some other projects and products, he decided to focus on the home. So dinnerware, furniture, and had a very long and prolific career in design. The first very successful product was American Modern, which was a modern ceramic dinnerware for the American home. And it was first to introduce mix and match, so mix and match colors, no decorative detail, very simple modern forms, but mass produced. It was in production, began in 1939, and it became the best-selling dinnerware in history. So that was 1939. By 1942, he and Mary purchased the property in Garrison for a summer home, 75 acres, which then from that point forward until his death in 1976 would become a major focus, so that developing the land, building the home, cultivating the landscape, he continued this for over 34 years, during which time he continued to produce a number of lines for the American home.
What was the property like when he first saw it, before he put any of his touches on it?
What he found, what he and Mary found in 1942 was a devastated landscape. It had been first a logging site, then a quarry, so it was named King's Quarry, and that was the turn of the century into the early 1900s, so that had been abandoned, as many of the quarries along the Hudson River had been, but they saw it, they found it. He, as the extraordinary visionary that he was, saw what it could become and devoted the rest of his life to Manitoga, which he named the place, and Manitoga was borrowed from Algonquin words meaning place of great spirit. So I believe, despite the devastation, he felt the spirit, and he cultivated that and celebrated it. And that's one of the things that we continue to do today.
It is a very curated, thought out, incredible experience coming here. And that is every detail was considered by him. Tell us about the experience he created.
For the visitor. And he did have visitors in his lifetime and loved to share the place with them. And so the experience began, I'm going to say, in New York City, or wherever you traveled from, because you know we're not that far. We're about an hour north of New York City. And he had a home there as well. So one would arrive by car or perhaps by train, and you would enter a hemlock-lined drive and tunnel, come up to the house, and yet you wouldn't see the house because he had designed it in such a way that it was shrouded by landscape and integrated into the land so that he would greet you at the door, and he would send you on your way to what was what we call today the Quarry Pool Path. So this beautifully designed and orchestrated walk through the woodland garden or through the forest so that you would shed work, you'd shed the city life, and you would be inspired by this intimacy with nature. So in a very short walk, quarter of a mile, not even, you would have a variety of experiences in the landscape. So outdoor rooms, some overhead canopies of hemlock, beautiful moss-covered open patches, a blooming laurel tunnel, right, that you would feel on your shoulders, the scent, so that it was about, and then of course, how could I forget, crossing the waterfall, the magnificent waterfall that he created. He redirected a mountain stream, created the waterfall so that it would feed what had been the abandoned quarry pit that he transformed into a magical swimming hole. So that would all be unveiled slowly with high drama as you navigated the landscape. And then through that experience, you would look back and you would see the house or parts of the house and the studio, which are two separate structures, but one home connected by a pergola. And that is on the edge of the quarry and integrated into the site with the granite boulders. So it was this gradual unfolding and a heightening of all of your senses. So it was, of course, visual, but it was aural and the smells of the landscape, the tactile qualities of, you know, the visual texture, but also the actual texture of, you know, feeling moss underfoot or the laurel branch brush your shoulder. So you would have that extraordinary experience, and you would come into the house, and when you come into the house, you bring the landscape with you, because the granite from the quarry edge becomes the flooring of the living room.
We're perched on boulders right now.
We are perched on boulders and are looking at a wall that's painted a dark green like fresco but has embedded hemlock needles in it. So there is this dialogue between interior and exteriors and a seamless transition.
What is the acreage of the area we walked around, that journey you just described?
It's about 4 acres, what we call the inner core of the property, which we walked through physically, and we've just described verbally, right. That rim. It's about 4 acres. The intent was that the feeling was not orchestrated, but natural, that this was a natural landscape. I'm going to talk a little bit about the palette that he used in the landscape, which were native plants to the Hudson Highlands. So the hemlocks, dogwoods, ferns, mosses, mountain laurel, oaks, and celebrated those for a variety of reasons. One, of course, it was to embrace the native landscape, to celebrate that, but also because in the end, as we know today, a native landscape is going to take less time and less expenditure to care for because they're not exotic species that have special needs.
But the hemlocks are currently in trouble.
The hemlocks are in trouble. We, like a majority of the northeastern region, have the woolly adelgid disease. So we have lost at Manitoba about 75% of our forests in the upper landscape. We're not alone. It's not eradicated. We have a maintenance program so that the large hemlocks that define that quarry pool path walk have been sprayed and injected to stabilize them. So we're in a process of stabilization. And then we'll look at alternatives as we look to the future. But that's, unlike a building, A building is architecture. We can restore it to what it was at a certain period of time, and we're relatively confident in that. Landscape changes. Diseases, blight, weather patterns. Even in his lifetime, there was a hurricane, and he was thrilled by it, the power of it, and it felled a number of trees, and he actually redirected some of his paths to demonstrate that. There was an embracing of that which was, and then a desire to reveal the power of nature, the power of something well-designed, with the goal of enhancement of daily living. And that's from, you know, his dinnerware to the house that he created to live in, to the programs that he helped develop for the parks in Washington, D.C., was a celebration of daily life, of daily living.
The property is 75 acres, correct. And this is what we've just talked about mostly is four, you said. What happens on the other 71
what
acres?
What happens on the other? Well, there are about 4 miles of what we call woodland paths, so that designed in his lifetime, again, working with the natural terrain, the plantings that were there, and they were actually called the winter walk, the autumn walk, and they were directional. Right, and all suggested a variety of experiences. And today, those trails, we maintain those trails to the best of our ability. We welcome hikers daily from sunrise to sunset. And the experience is one not quite as managed, okay, as the inner quarry, but there are subtle interventions that make it, as someone described to me, the ease of a hike, you know, a graciousness, you know, so steps that are placed, transitions that are made, views that unfold, beautiful carpets of ferns, right, and in these beautiful glades. And one of the paths goes up to what's called Lost Pond. It's a crater that fills in naturally, and then so it fills and then it drains, and he allowed, unlike in the inner core, the landscape to take it over, and what he designed was the entry. So similar to that beautiful laurel tunnel that we walked through, there's an entrance of laurel. You get a sense of, ooh, I've been here before, or there's something very familiar having walked other parts of the property. And suddenly the smaller glade opens up, and it's a secret, and we call it the Lost Pond. It's really quite, and that connects via the Osborne Loop to the Appalachian Trail.
We're speaking with Allison Cross, the executive director of the National Historic Landmark Manitoga, Russell Wright's historic home, studio, and woodland garden. Russell Wright died in 1976. We continue our conversation by talking about what happened to Manitoga after that.
Actually, before his death, he and his daughter, Annie Wright, met with and gave the property, gave Manitoga, to the Nature Conservancy. But Annie retained life tenancy in the house itself. After so many years, so 1975 to about 1983, the Conservancy cared for the land, but it was determined that it was not their mission or the organization's mission to care for architecture. We're not unique, but we are among the few modernist homes and landscapes that have the designation of a National Historic Landmark. Wright designed Manitoga in such a way that the buildings, the structures, and the landscape are integrated and inseparable. So it was deemed, you know, by Annie Wright at the time and close people who had cared about Russell Wright and Manitoga that it was important to form a separate independent nonprofit that could then care for and steward Manitoga. So that happened in 1984. Manitoga Inc. was founded, and Manitoga Inc. remains the nonprofit that is the caretaker of Manitoga, the place.
And there is a lot of incredible stuff happening all the time. Yes. Current day, what's going down?
Well, we do have, and we've begun in early May, our public tours. So it's a wonderful experience, about an hour and a half, and they're called the House studio and landscape tours, and visitors do what we did today, Sarah. They take the quarry pool path, and then they visit the studio and the house. Actually, the experience begins with a documentary that talks about the Wright's early professional career. Mm-hmm. So those we offer Friday through Monday, twice daily. Right. We also have, beginning very shortly, our Nature and Design Camp that has been running for over 25 years. Wow. Yes, we have 250 youngsters from the age of 5 to 12. They're 5 separate weekly day camp sessions, and they explore topics of nature and design, and they use the site as their laboratory. And it's thematic, so wayfinding, caring for nature, where the wild things are is the first one, and that's sold out and very popular. And sure. There's one about theater, you know, and appetite for design, and that ties into, you know, designing picnics and thinking about design in all of its elements. So
5 to 12, you said, not 31?
Not 31, sorry, though there has been talk to try to create, perhaps not week-long, but similar immersive experiences for adults, because we need that.
Tell us about the artist residencies, please.
Well, it's a new initiative for Manitoba, but it really recalls the legacy of the site. So we, beginning this year, have invited and will continue to invite artists, and that visual artists, choreographers, composers, to be inspired by the site, as Russell Wright was in his day personally, and to create a new work that can be shared with the public. Let's embrace that place of great spirit, continue to inspire not only daily visitors, but artists who I've worked with most of my life, and bring incredible insight, passion, and community to a place. Artists do that. So Melissa McGill is the artist this year. And we actually have Melissa McGill and then Ben Neal. We happen to have in our very first year two artists. But the first work that was launched is called Palmas, and it is a surround sound installation. Melissa is a resident of Beacon now, which is a town, a couple of towns north, bustling, exciting place, happens to be where I was born. I'm very proud of that. And she's been an artist for a number of years, working with sound, working with form. And she, knowing the place, felt that a sound piece was something that she wanted to explore here. So Palmas is based on, or it's a recording of a palmero, who is one of the participants in the tradition of flamenco. It's the clapping. It's actually the clapping and the stamping that accompanies the dance. It is an integral part of it. This is a recording that she had begun a while ago with Arturo Martinez, who is the palmero, and claps. And it, depending on when you hear it, one might think of birds in flight, of a rainstorm, or simply sometimes clapping. You know, it enlivens the landscape in such a very beautiful way. But Melissa's work for many years and continues to explore the idea of presence and absence, solid and void, pauses and accents. And there's something about Manitoba and its quarry, and rock being removed and then water filling in and the orchestration, that she felt it was a good starting point. And then the way that the speakers are positioned, she actually used the physical site, she and her sound designer, Paul Galuzzo, the reverberation from the quarry walls and the water itself. So it's extraordinary, it's encompassing. You know, it truly, and we hope that all of the artists will use the site in such a profound way so that it only serves to enhance what is already here and very powerful. So, and we have a variety of ways to experience that. It's actually, the piece itself is about 7.5 minute duration with, as I said, pauses and accents that frame the natural sounds of Manitoba. And you can experience it in different levels. You know, we went down to the water's edge and up below and in the house. And so the way, if you come on a guided tour, at the conclusion of that tour, you will hear the piece on one of the upper terraces. And you become a spectator in this performance, this surround sound performance. And then we have a number of artist-led tours so that Melissa herself will be here, and then we'll explore the site a little bit more in depth and have the piece on a continuous loop. And then we're having another tour called Encountering Palmas, which is a type of open house, so that it will not be a guided tour, but visitors will be allowed to explore the landscape and the house and studio with the piece on at their leisure for a couple of hours.
And Melissa McGill has a performance as well.
Yes, as part of her residency. And residency is a little different than the traditional because they don't live here on site, but the idea is that...
Oh, I do now. I should have told you. I live here now. Is that okay?
Great. That's the point. That is the point, to have people feel at home here. So welcome.
You can Thank
join
you.
Us. So that it's having a many-month relationship with Manitoba to develop a work and some programs and experiences. And so part of Palmas is the sound installation, but then a performance that Melissa will produce with Arturo Martinez for September 27th. And it will be an ensemble of musicians, singers, and dancers that will be based on the tradition of flamenco, but it will be, as her sound piece is, site-specific. So they will produce it in response to Manitoba, and we're going to have a temporary platform at the base of the waterfall, and it will be magical. And we will use the quarry as a natural amphitheater.
Allison, I am devastated to say that my time at Manitoba today has to end. But thank you so much for all of your time, and I hope to see you again very soon.
Indeed. Please come back.
Manitoba is located in Garrison, New York. For more information about the site and opportunities to visit, check out russellwrightcenter.org. This segment is available online at wamc.org/roundtable, along with further conversation with Allison Cross, the executive director of Manitoba, about Ben Neal, the second residency artist working at Manitoba this summer. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.